So mycotoxins are compounds that are produced by fungal organisms, and they are toxic to mammalian herbivores that consume them. So as you mentioned, there's definitely a whole host of concerns for human consumers, but in addition, you know, livestock are mammals as well. So basically, physiologically, the same impacts are seen in animals that consume these contaminants.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast brought you by Wisenetics. I'm Carlos Campabadal, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed science industry. Please get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead of today's episode. So today, it is a great pleasure to introduce you our guest, Dr. Jennifer Duringer. She is an assistant professor, senior researcher, and director of the Endophyte Service Laboratory at Oregon State University. So Jennifer, welcome. It's a pleasure having you here. I'm pretty sure the audience will be very excited to hear all the great information you're going to share with us today. So just to start off, Jennifer, if you could just kind of tell us a little bit about your background and we'll hit it from there.
Well, I guess going far back, I grew up in Chicago. And so I was in kind of a city-like environment, but was always interested in the outside world. And so I started exploring issues in marine science. And so that brought me out to Oregon State University. And as a lot of people do in their undergraduate, I kind of switched gears a little bit and got into toxicology. At the time, as an undergrad, they didn't offer a program in toxicology, so I kind of had an emphasis in that, and then kind of rolled right into grad school in toxicology. So I have my PhD in toxicology, and so that kind of forms the basis for the questions that I ask and kind of the point of concern that I come for from the animals, specifically the livestock that are consuming feed. And then as I developed my program and my studies and postdoc, I became interested in the outreach aspect of the work that we do. So the interest, the research is very interesting, but trying to translate that information to farmers, growers, livestock managers, and other users that would be integrating that information, but then also that feedback loop that's happened. So, you know, they're taking our information and using it, but then new questions come up, concerns, things like that. I often assist in interpretation of results as well. So I really enjoy kind of, again, that feedback loop that exists. So kind of partnering the research that we do in the lab with the service application as well.
Great. No. It seems like so far a great career, and that's very interesting. And for our audience, please, if you have any questions throughout the podcast, please comment on the section, and we'll make sure to get them to Jennifer. So, Jennifer, you're talking about a lot about, you know, that your work as you went through your undergrad and your PhD and grad studies overall in toxicology. So let's start a little bit talking about that. You know, I'm also a grain person in reality of with background on feed manufacturing. So toxicology is a very important thing, especially when we're talking about feed safety overall and animal performance. So why don't we give it up a little bit and let's start, you know, kind of to introduce the topic, let's start from the basics and kind of tell us a little bit about mycotoxins, you know, and what you see that are the issues and on animal feed, of course, humans too. But since we're in a feed science podcast, let's focus on animals from that sense.
Yeah, so mycotoxins are compounds that are produced by fungal organisms, and they are toxic to mammalian herbivores that consume them. So as you mentioned, there's definitely a whole host of concerns for human consumers, but in addition, you know, livestock are mammals as well. So basically, physiologically, the same impacts are seen in animals that consume these contaminants. Mycotoxins and production of them, they're kind of a really difficult thing to control. There's a lot of different measures that have been developed through research and just trying to control the spread of mycotoxins. A lot of it starts in the field when crops are harvested and then moves into storage, and then whether or not that storage is long-term. And so you also have kind of the transport piece where those food materials are moved from the storage facility out to livestock managers. But in and of themselves, especially with the endophyte mycotoxins, which is one of the things our laboratory focuses on, the endophyte fungus in and of itself is generally beneficial to the plant. It provides a lot of drought and stress tolerance to the plant, but then also produces these mycotoxins. Some of them are actually insect toxicants, so they work as a pest deterrent, which again is a positive thing both for the grass and the crop grower. But then any of those materials that enter the animal feed stream would be toxic to the animals.
Yeah, okay, of course. And so that gets us to the animals. And let's just go a little bit more. And we could go back later because I want to ask a little bit more about mycotoxins per se. But as you put the topic of they get into the animal feed stream, let's call it that way, if I'm a producer, livestock, agriculture, whatever, what should I do in order to be able to prevent them? I mean, let's say I just buy the feed, or make my own feed, but I don't have any control of the fields of where those commodities are made for the feed are. What would you suggest, or what will be your steps to prevent them?
The primary step is to have that feed material tested. There are products on the market that will bind mycotoxin agents, and that is starting to get more and more complicated as far as lots of products are on the market for use, but there tends to be a financial burden. And so as far as, is it worth it to administer that to your entire herd? So really, if you kind of back up to the very beginning, simply getting your feed tested and knowing what the concentration of the mycotoxins of concern are is probably your best bet at food safety and prevention of those mycotoxins entering into the feed stream for your animals. I do some lectures for veterinary students, and so I always tell them that wherever in the world you'll be practicing, or for livestock owners and managers, wherever your herd is, it's good to have a basic idea of what the mycotoxins of concern are in the area that you are. And so that will vary across the globe where you are. And so just kind of becoming aware of what those compounds would be, and then say if it's corn, you know that I should be asking for these three mycotoxins and what their test values are. If I'm feeding endophyte infected hay, which is kind of our specialty, I need to be concerned about these mycotoxins. So just knowing what the mycotoxins are and then asking for the testing to be performed on those feed materials.
If I'm concerned being a producer, I kind of need to know a little bit where my feed is coming, at least from the feed ingredients perspective, in order to be able to choose those mycotoxins. Or will you have a different suggestion to say, hey, always test for this, and that, and then try to move depending where your feed coming, or what will be like a simple strategy for a grower from that perspective?
So say you're bringing in hay, just knowing that, especially in our area of the world, you would be concerned for ergot alkaloids and Lolotrim B, which is a toxicant found in perennial ryegrass primarily. And so going to the person you're purchasing the feed from, or if you're growing it yourself, submitting samples for testing and asking what are the levels of these toxicants in the feed material, fortunately, unfortunately, the testing is generally non-obligatory, so it's not regulated, so it's not required for a lot of feed suppliers to do this testing. And so it kind of behooves the livestock manager to ask for this. And we have found that typically when people are asking for that, then the feed producers will do the testing.
And what tests do you recommend for this mycotoxins, for anybody to say, hey, use this type of system, or, you know, run it to this particular lab, private labs, or what will be your guidance overall? I know it could vary a lot where you're located and what resources you have, but what would you suggest somebody that is trying to think about implementing something?
Well, extension agents in the United States, at least, extension agents are a good source of information on where some available labs might be. Some, like Oregon State University, we offer some testing throughout just my lab, but other labs on campus too. But there are other things we do not cover in the testing, so we can provide advice on where to go for those testing pieces. So definitely as a kind of a first point of reference, I would try to reach out to your extension agents and see if they have information. If that's not the case, there are more national lab type places like Dairy One. And so they receive samples for a lot of nutritional analyses, but they often can provide information on, I think they keep a list of labs that provide testing that goes above and beyond what they are able to offer. So just contacting reputable labs, if they don't offer the testing, then kind of asking for a reference from them.
And that's very good information. I mean, I think we here in the United States, we're, I'm going to say the word probably blessed, and that we have a very good land grant university system that has, like you said, extension agents and research facilities that to help the farmers, the community itself. And I put my hat on that coming from Kansas State University, but I think it's something, like you said, a good source of information, and most land grant universities should have it. And now that gets me a little bit more curious. And of course, for our audience, if you please, if you learn something new today, please share this video. But going back, that makes me curious because, you know, I never actually handle mycotoxin from a hay perspective. I've always been more involved with grain. You know, I'm a grain storage guy. But is there no any type of like ELISA kit or something similar to test for hay? I'm always on the storage, so not really on the hay side. On the grain storage, not on the hay side. So, is there like a quick test, something that might be effective, or is it too broad depending on what you're looking for?
So as a toxicologist, one of the bases of my lab is chemistry and analytical chemistry. So yes, there are sort of shorter tests available as opposed to doing kind of the tried and true HPLC connected to like either UV detector or mass spec. Those tests do tend to be more expensive. There are a number of companies that have lateral flow devices, and that most of them are even water-based in their extraction. And so if you're lucky, and if you're looking for like aflatoxin in corn and things that are just routinely tested over and over again, there's actually quite a few companies. And there's been a lot of innovation on this over the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years as well, as far as trying to increase the market of those tests that are available, and then kind of deepening the matrices. So kind of going back to analytical chemistry, if I want to test for aflatoxin on corn versus silage versus hay, that's actually three different methods as a chemist I have to come up with in order to validate and make sure the answer that I'm providing to you is accurate, and you know, we can stand behind it, you know, in the case of legal possibilities and things that might come up. And so, but yes, there are some, I guess, more simple, quick test kits that are becoming available, and they are relatively user-friendly as far as if you kind of have a simple grinder and a bench and just sort of a clean space in a room, you could probably buy these instruments. And then a lot of them even have software available now for self-validation. And so, you know, you can run, you know, so if you're not necessarily a laboratory technician, they provide a standard test kit, you can do the quality control, and then send that validation back to the home office of that company. And you can be validating and checking that, you know, every few months, just to make sure that your instrument is still in compliance. So yeah, there is definitely kind of a lot of good things on the horizon in terms of testing for mycotoxins.
Great. No, that's always very important as we progress in the with research and you know, overall. I'm a true believer that that sampling is key, especially and I think that's usually the mistake that sometimes a lot, especially you're in a grain elevator, you're a feed miller, and I deal with flour millers too, and soy crushers, you know, that sampling sometimes is not the best. And I understand why, logistics costs and many other factors. But if you don't get a composite represented sample of your lot, whatever that size of that lot is, it is very difficult. And there's a lot of information, even how to sample and all the stuff out there. I mean, but sometimes I feel that people don't pay that much attention. And so how you monitor, how you evaluate it can vary. And that brings us a little bit through to some questions that, you know, what are the differences in how mycotoxins are monitored throughout the world? We could start maybe with what you have seen based on your experience.
Yeah. Do you mean in terms of the testing that's performed across the different countries? Or?
Yeah. And then, of course, also beside the testing, if there's I'm just thinking if I'm walking through a field of hay, you know, and with somebody from the field can identify that. I mean, I know there's other things you could do, but let's start from that testing first, and then we can move forward if there's something else that might be helpful.
Yeah, I would start with the equivalent of like within our states here, we have departments of agriculture, but then you could step out even a little broader and look at the USDA. And then whatever country you're in, there should be some sort of agricultural agency functioning like that. So I would reach out to them and see if they have any standards of sampling and protocols for testing, because throughout different countries, the regulations on what's allowed for contamination and different feed materials varies, and sometimes it varies quite a lot. So the EU and Japan and Pacific Rim countries, they tend to be much more restrictive in the limits that they will allow in their feed material. And then the United States kind of is, you know, a little bit of a step away from that. But it can kind of run the gamut. And it also runs the gamut on the monitoring that's done. And that has to be taken into consideration, just the whole pipeline and stream from harvest to animal consumer. That differs widely across the globe. And so I feel like as of late, there's more efforts in trying to take that into consideration. So if things mostly go from small farm to small farm, that's much different in the way we do agriculture in the United States and Europe. And so just trying to take all of these variables into consideration and, you know, ultimately just trying to provide a stream for safe feed.
Great. No, that's important. And, you know, it is... One thing that I'm always curious is that due to my work, I have to travel and interact with a lot of international people outside the United States focusing on feed manufacturing. And, you know, here in the U.S., traditionally on the grain base, you know, people are always concerned corn more aflatoxin than anything else. But once you go to other countries, they will start talking about other mycotoxins more, and ochratoxin and sirolinone that in the U.S. is very minimal. So what are your thoughts on those?
So again, just going back to that global picture of like being aware of what mycotoxins are produced in different areas of the world. So corn grown in the United States versus Mexico versus Europe. They're, you know, those environments are set up differently for the fungus to grow and colonize and produce mycotoxins. So, and there's even microclimates too. So looking at the Midwest versus the West Coast versus the East Coast. So just kind of being aware of what the mycotoxins of concern are, because, you know, you probably don't want to develop a testing program for something that's not going to come up. But that kind of also circles back to doing some of the basic research and monitoring, just kind of year to year, just checking and seeing, you know, what mycotoxins are coming up. Unfortunately, with climate change, we are seeing the spread, quote unquote, of new mycotoxins to crops they have not been detected in before. And then we have this area we call emerging mycotoxins, and it's mostly emerging just because we're developing better technologies and analytical chemistry to detect all these compounds. And so, you know, it used to be kind of the big six mycotoxins, and now we're able to start expanding that a little bit just because of the instrumentation we have available.
I heard somewhere reading that there's always more than 300 different types of mycotoxins, but we always focus on the big six and which are now seven or eight, if I remember correctly, depending on who you talk to. But that always, when I read that and I think about it, you know, from a animal producer, people will be all these mycotoxins, I'm never going to finish testing, but of course there's different levels of the concentrations and things like that. So that's a little bit of kind of interesting to think. So going to that specific area, and let me just share to our audience, please like us. Give us, please, the thumbs up if you like this video today. And just, Jennifer, going back a little bit, as we talk about, you know, that there's no differences between the countries, there's more work coming out, more mycotoxins being discovered, climate change making an issue. That, at the end of the day, comes up to what the scientific community is doing. Of course, with your background being a scientist, researcher, can you tell us a little bit more about what is the current research that is currently being done by you or any of your fellow peers over there in your university to make overall feed safer?
So touching back on that monitoring piece, for example, I've been working with the University of Florida with the extension agents there, sampling grasses throughout the state of Florida. So there's quite a bit of variation in climate and geography there. And so just sampling those grasses and evaluating for 60 different mycotoxins. And so the majority of those are coming up as zeros. And so, but just trying to develop some sort of, you know, my hope would be like a global database that would be open source, so we could dump in data and information from samples that we've been testing over time. And so we can potentially use AI and other things to see if there's a new trend or pattern emerging again with weather and climate changing and that sort of thing. So doing some of those like consistent monitoring projects, which I know sometimes they're a little bit boring, but and then continuing to do relevant toxicology assays. We're tending to move away from just give a high dose of a toxicant to a specific livestock species and kind of watch what happens. We're trying to use more animal models. For example, at Oregon State University, we have a zebrafish model that you can provide the dose of the toxicant at different levels and try to see what happens with organ development and things like that. And then there's a lot of research, again, trying to go into the testing end of things. You know, we know it's expensive and we don't want that to be a barrier for a lot of people putting, say, feed into the market, because there's limited feed available pretty much every country you go to. And so the more that we can lower that barrier to feed entering the market, but to do so safely, would definitely be a big goal of ours.
Yes, absolutely. No, this is very interesting. And I in all these areas, and like you said, of course, there's less feed available, growing population, meet the demand of everybody's food. And that takes a lot of effort, just overall thinking from a research and scientific perspective of the goals that we have to focus overall. So I definitely agree on all that. I had the opportunity to work in different international development projects related to post-harvest practices and have seen how that variation in between countries and standards and how mycotoxins from the grain perspective affect the health of humans. But, you know, like I said, we're here to talk about animal feed and that's important. So just overall, what would you recommend overall? I know you do more, as I understand, more into the silage, into the hay. But from a grain perspective, if I'm, besides use, is there anything else that you might recommend a producer besides using mycotoxin binders or just trying to avoid certain areas that they might buying feed ingredients from that location? Is there any other practice or anything else, any other technology out there that might be helpful to prevent them or mitigate them?
This goes back to probably working with your extension agent a bit, and this is back in the field, but proper harvesting of crop material is really important. So in the Willamette Valley, we have grass seed, which that crop gets pulled off, and then we have the hay, which is what we're interested in testing. So definitely looking at temperature and humidity and all those variables, and when, you know, the hay gets flailed and how long it's sitting in the field, and then making sure, you know, I know if it rains, it rains. We can't control the weather. But, you know, harvesting that material hopefully in a method that's conducive to mold not growing. And so that once stuff enters into storage, it's possible in certain species of fungi in their production of mycotoxins, it's possible for mycotoxins to continue to be produced once that feed material is stored. So I would say being pretty meticulous in how your feed material is harvested from that very beginning point to storage, that would be a good place to put some effort.
So would that also, besides those storage practices, you will say any particular storage, specifically moisture content, storage shed or covers, or anything particular that you say might be helpful, or all of the above?
Yeah, definitely pretty much all of the above. It will vary a little bit based on your feed material. So yeah, there's grain silos, of course, that will store the grain. And there's a number of operations that will do periodic probing. So if material is stored over a number of months, they'll probe and take a sample out of that grain silo just to make sure that no additional mycotoxins have been produced based on sort of the baseline level they had for testing when that material went into the grain silo. So I know, for instance, like in Canada, when the weather gets colder, apparently like the very outside of those grain silos, the grain that's kind of touching those outside of the silos, it can be conducive for the production of zearalenone, which actually kind of likes colder temperatures. So just kind of, you know, again, things to be aware and sort of the microclimate that you're in.
Wow, I didn't know that one on zearalenone and cold temperatures, but yeah, so that's very good information, especially for our Canadian friends there too. So, of course, for our audience, please visit our site, wisenetics.com, and learn more about all of our potted segments like poultry, swine, dairy, beef, feed mill like this one, and of course, pet food. So we appreciate it. So, well, we're coming close to an end of the time that we have for this podcast, but we appreciate a lot of the information you have shared with you. And I think the how can a person from, you know, Chicago ended up in toxicology, which is very, very different compared to some ways, which is great, by the way. But tell us a little bit about overall how that happened. You briefly mentioned it through the introduction, and where you see your career going on for future research projects.
Yeah, no, it's actually a question I get commonly from students when I'm doing an exit interview with them or something, is they almost always want to know what your career path was. Just maybe it's intriguing and interesting from a personal point of view. But yeah, no, I just have always loved the natural world. You know, I grew up in the city and it was great. I enjoyed all the culture and other things it had to offer, but definitely like to be in the sort of outdoor environment and interacting with people and livestock and just the agricultural world. In the Willamette Valley, Oregon, where we are here, it's just absolutely beautiful and grow all kinds of crops. And so it can be a little bit challenging from that perspective sometimes. I think there's over like 200 crops that are grown in the state of Oregon. So
wow.
So we're definitely working. Yeah, it's a lot. So we're definitely working.
I love the wine, by the way. I love the Oregon wine.
Oh, so. Yeah. No, it's awesome. But yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, there have been, you know, unintended overlaps between some of the work that we do with other crops and other components of the agricultural system. So, but yeah, I really enjoy this, the personal perspective, being able to do my research and be in the lab and have students and mentor students, but then be able to tie that back to the greater agricultural community.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Great, perfect, and thank you very much. And so as we finalize today's podcast, you know, we always like to ask our guests, what do you recommend, or what will be your favorite book or reference or website if somebody wants to learn more about mycotoxins, about feed safety, you know, something that if I want to learn more about myself, what do you send somebody?
I would definitely start with your state agriculture department and also the USDA. There tends to be more general information there, so it's a good starting point. Of course, your extension agents as well. If you want to kind of dive a little bit deeper and go to something that's more specifically scientific, there's a journal called the World Mycotoxin Journal, and it's ranked pretty high. And so there's a lot of good research that is put into that journal for information. And then if you're interested in attending conferences, every 2 years, there's the World Mycotoxin Forum. And so it kind of jumps around in locations. It's a very international audience, which is kind of attractive to me, because then you get to see and listen to how people are approaching the problems of mycotoxins within the system that they exist. And so it kind of generates a lot of new ideas, besides kind of being fun to meet new and interesting people. And then there are quite a few feed companies. So, you know, Alltech and Romer Labs and places like that, that either offer testing or kind of offer mycotoxin solutions. And for the most part, they have good information in kind of their synopsized pieces on, say, corn, or kind of flip it to specific mycotoxins, so aflatoxins. So these are kind of the main points of concern of toxicity for your animal. And here's what the regulated levels are in specific feed materials. So I would say a lot of that information hasn't changed all that much, especially for the big six mycotoxins in the last number of years. So I would say that information is pretty stable. So reaching out to those sources would be a good place for information.
Great. Perfect. So we appreciate Jennifer, your time today, all this great information. I'm pretty sure the audience are going to now have a better understanding overall of mycotoxins as we go along. And with that, thank you very much for joining us today. Any last comments that you might want to share with the audience?
If anyone wants to reach out with any questions, comments, I'm always happy to do a Zoom meeting or take a phone call. And if you're ever out in Oregon coming through Corvallis, I'd be happy to show you around the lab and talk to you about mycotoxins.
Great. I'm pretty sure a lot of people will take your word and do it. So appreciate it. Thank you very much. So with that, that concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on any of our future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is very valuable to us. Until next time, this is Carlos Campabadal from Kansas State University from the Feed Science Podcast signing off. Thank you very much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.